This last week has been an interesting week for me. As I mentioned, Mike taking the message last week gave me a little bit more time. And one morning, I actually got up before dawn, which is something that has been kind of few and far between. I've actually been approaching dawn from the other side a lot lately, staying up until, as in, and not getting up for. But this day I was able to get up and have some quiet time, just to be able to sit for a bit in the quiet and in the dark and watch things change. And I wrote a little piece that went into our newsletter that I got out this week. And I wanted to read it to you this morning because it carries kind of the threads of about three different themes that have been just coalescing in my mind over the last few weeks. And I want to talk about those this morning. And so maybe this is a good start. If it's not, get a cup of coffee. 5 a.m. Haven't seen 5 a.m. in a while. Hours have shifted so that I routinely see light and dark, but not so much the time in between. Remembering how much I love this hour of transition, I tell myself I need to come here more often, but no promise is really intended. Cool air, not a breeze, pours over the sill of the open window like water over the edge of an overflowing bathtub streaming past bare feet. Light begins silhouetting the hilltop trees, and I can actually feel the planet underneath turning toward the heat of another August day. Every time I look, sky is brighter, hillside details and colors emerging. One distant bird sounds off, now dozens, some right outside the window, and I realize swallows have built a nest under the eaves. When did that happen? How did I miss the process? Any moment the sun will crest the hill, bringing the heat and ending this breath-held moment between before. Light enough now to see the little round sticker on my forearm. It's still there, survived the night. Our five-year-old son insisting before bed that I close my eyes and hold out my arm just like this so he could give me a present. Looks like an orange with a smiling face. Or maybe the smiling sun about to make its appearance. Little things, little details of childhood. The brightening house is full of them. I usually find myself trying to clean them up. But yesterday my wife told me she bought him school supplies for kindergarten that starts in just a few days. School supplies. A lunchbox. Rite of passage of sorts. Not so subtle reminder that his time of benevolent captivity in our home is spinning out like a planet towards sunrise. Time-lapse photography. Light and shadow visibly moving across carpet and walls. Life overflowing past bare feet. Another hot August day. How many Augusts? How many days? How many left? This day's details illuminate with the increasing light. What must be done? Who must be seen? What will be left over to do another day? All these details, all this activity, does any of it mean anything? Is there any significance here or just movement? But there's a sticker on my arm. Proof of life, like a watch in the sand of a deserted beach stating that someone was here, that intelligent life once passed this way. An impossibly orange face reminds me that somewhere in this silent house, my son is sleeping, blissfully unaware of the coming heat. All this activity, all these details mean at least that much to him, though he knows nothing of it. Maybe his unawareness of the gift makes it even more significant to those of us who are, who find themselves holding a long breath at 5 a.m., sitting quietly in the betweenness and the beforeness of another hot August day. I know this one is a little oblique, kind of stream of consciousness, a little moody. Isn't it always moody at 5 a.m., I think? I remember sitting there and just starting to write sensations, write impressions, and then the themes started to emerge, the things that I've been thinking about for these last few weeks. And one of them, obviously, is this incessant passage of time. Time is passing so quickly. And it's almost highlighted by our five-year-old son, by Brennan. You know, you can watch things move so quickly in his life. You know, and as the days just turn into weeks overnight, it seems like, and then the weeks into months, and now he's going to kindergarten, and we're buying him school supplies. And this time that we had him all to ourselves, you know, in our house, where he doesn't go anywhere. He's kind of like a puppy. He's ours. And now he's going to school, and he's going to be theirs. And then pretty soon he's going to be like his 14-year-old brother and his 19-year-old sister. And it just goes and goes and goes. And I'm looking at that, and he's kind of a child of our old age, you know? You know, not as dramatic as Abram and Isaac, you know. He was 100 when he had his child. I was 48 when we had ours and our last one here. But you know what? It was just old enough. I'm old enough to literally be his grandfather, and I'm old enough to see him in a different light. I remember when Sean was his age, I was trying to rush him through. I kept saying things like, you know, I think I'll like him better when he can do this. No, I'll like him better when he's out of diapers. I'll like him better when he can talk to me. You know, I'll be able to connect to him more when he can do whatever. And with Brennan, it's exactly the opposite. Every time he pronounces a word correctly, I you know, something chokes in me, and I mourn the loss of the childish way that he used to pronounce things. And the more coordinated he gets and the more aware that he is, just reminds me of how fast all this stuff is going, you know. And yet, at the same time, Brennan is my teacher. He, you know, he's one of my best teachers right now. He teaches me to keep my feet on the ground even when I'm not doing it. He teaches me that the most important moment is just the one that you're in. He teaches me that the most insignificant detail can be this amazing adventure, and that size doesn't matter. You know, we place our significance in all these various ways, and Brennan helps me to remember the preciousness of all these moments. Yesterday, I was flipping channels, and Lawrence of Arabia came on, and I just love that movie, and I said, I'm not going to get involved in a five-hour movie, but of course, I had to watch the first half because I got sucked in. And so here's this story of this man who is, you know, ambitious beyond measure, and is inserting himself into history and trying to make things happen and making huge things happen, directing the course of a world war, at least in one theater. And here's my little five-year-old son running up to me with Easter eggs that he had, and he wanted me to see what was inside because he was bringing me presents. And actually what he did was he raided the little gummy bear vitamins that Marion has for him, and he was putting them in the thing and giving them to me. Good thing it wasn't codeine or Oxycontin or something. I don't know. I'm just eating the stuff. It's like, okay. But the juxtaposition couldn't have been more stark. I mean, Lawrence of Arabia and Brennan. And yet, who's to say that what Brennan is doing is any less significant than what he did? You know, if you really come down to it, everything in life is equally meaningless or equally meaningful, depending on what you bring to it. Not depending on what it is intrinsically. You know, as the time is running headlong toward whatever, you know, I'm going to die someday like everybody else. At the end of that, at the end of my life, at the end of all things, what's going to be significant and what isn't? Brennan is helping to teach me to remember the things that really are significant. And just not the stuff that I've learned to do. Not the stuff that I've learned that gives me some sort of approval or acceptance. And this is so incredibly important that if I can't find meaning and purpose in the smallest details, I'll never find them anywhere else. It's not possible because I'll be looking for all the wrong things. The tail will be wagging the dog. I'll be obsessive compulsive for the rest of my life if I don't realize that there's nothing really to be achieved to accomplish all of the purpose, to find all of the meaning that God put me here to find and to accomplish. You know, it's not about the size of it. And I started to think about how a few weeks ago we talked about being born in God's image. I don't know if some of you remember that. And we said that the essential part about being born in God's image was that he gave us the power to choose. You know, we could choose between good and evil. We could choose between relationship or not relationship. We could choose to love or not, which is the part that God gave us that is most like him. But now I'm realizing there's another part of it too. This notion of God's image. God created us in such a way that we sort of innately, intrinsically, just right off the bat, understand what's really important. We know how to dive into this moment. Maybe because we have no conception of any other moment, but we dive into this moment You know, the five-year-olds among us are fully present to what they're doing, and it's of supreme importance, no matter what it is. And in that moment, in that connection, in that not even necessarily feeling any different from anybody else, because the child will go up to anybody. It doesn't matter their color, their race, their creed. They have no knowledge of that. They treat everybody the same. They connect with everybody. And in that connection, in that immersion into moment, there is everything that can be known about meaning and purpose. Meaning defined as, who am I? Okay? Who am I? What does that mean? What does that even mean? You know, 15 years ago, you asked me who I am. I can't answer the question. I don't even know what the question means. Purpose. Why am I here? What am I doing here? And we're born in God's image in a way that we are living that out. You know, our whole lives at that age is full of this meaning and purpose, this connection with God. And then the first hurt comes, doesn't it? The first trauma, the first pain, the first knowing that suddenly that connection can be broken. You didn't know that it could be broken up to that point. Now you know that it can. It has been. You've been hurt. You've been betrayed. You know, you've been neglected at the very least. You know, or you've been abused at the very most, but that first hurt comes. And then what do? It's like we rebirth ourselves. We remake ourselves into another image, an image that we think will get us the things that we need, an image that we just think will help us to survive, first of all. But secondly, one that will give us approval, one that will take us where we need to go. And we recreate ourselves into a new image. And the first image gets put on the shelf. And sometimes we live this new image for so long that we even forget that we created it in the first place. And when circumstances change that cause us to create this new image, this new way of living life, this new attitude toward life, looking at life, when the circumstances change, guess what? The image remains. It's kind of like taxes. As soon as they get imposed, they never go away. You know, it's like that with this image that we create. It just doesn't go away. It persists. Can you remember your earliest childhood images? What are your earliest memories? And how far back can you go? I think this exercise kind of helps us to see. You know, my first memory that I can even think of, I was 4 years old and I had to have this open chest surgery. And I can remember, you know, this had been in 1960-ish, something like that. I can remember seeing the ceiling of a room. And it was that green industrial color and this black mask coming down. And I can remember there was this real sweet smell when the mask came down. I can remember that. You know, and that's it, just a flash. I can remember the only time that I can remember my dad spanking me. But I remember it. I can close my eyes and I can see it, you know. He was sitting on my bed. He had me over his knee in my room, and he was so angry. I remember looking up at his face, and it was all contorted, and it was like teeth-gritting anger. You know, just, oh, he was so mad. I have no idea what I did. And now with the advantage of age, I realize there was nothing that I could have done at that age to make him so angry. There was something else going on, and I was getting it. And I'm sure I was wailing and crying, and I don't remember that so much. I just remember my dad's face, and I remember his hand coming down. But it's a memory that stays with me and has stayed with me for what? You know, 40-something years now? I remember some later, some actual abuse that I had either repressed or forgotten. And it came back to me a few years ago, and I put it all together, and it was a close male relative. And by standards, you know, out there of what abuse is like, this was pretty minor, and it was short-lived. But something like that changes everything in your childhood. It changes the relationship to the adults around you. It changes your trust level. It just opens up new possibilities that didn't exist. And now I realize that that was part of the mix for me too. And I was kind of a bookish kid, you know, kind of the dweeb, kind of the geek. And my mom and my sister used to make fun of me. And I remember one time all of us getting ready together for bed or something in the bathroom, and they both laid into me and double-teamed me. And I remember at that point I decided, I remember thinking this, you know, however old I was, you know, 10, 11, that I wasn't going to be a geek anymore. I wasn't going to be the butt of their jokes anymore. And from that point on, I started to actually change the way that I lived my life. I went out for every sport that I could go out for, you know, and it was flag football and basketball and softball. And I actually started, I forced myself to go to a dance in eighth grade. I remember I hated the thing, but I went. I was just doing everything that I could to just be different, because being the way I was just didn't work. It was making fun of me. It was hurtful. And I took public speaking classes, and I started playing in a band in high school, and I started going to, I went out for the play and drama. I did everything that I could that I thought was going to get me to a place that was going to be a place of acceptance. And it sort of became who I was. And I forgot that there was any other person inside of me. And when my life came crashing down in my 30s, I had to figure something out. And through the course of some of the work that I did spiritually, and some of the centering prayer and the other types of techniques, stuff kind of bubbled up out of the ooze, and all of a sudden I remembered, you know what? I wasn't always a depressed person. I wasn't always this driven person who had to get the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. And this image of me when I was 8 years old kind of came back. And I remembered that I was a kid who was jumping up on the bed with uncontrolled joy and exuberance and running around and just loved doing whatever I was doing. I remember there was another person in there that I had remade myself in this other image. And it took a long time, but eventually that image started to break down. And so I started to understand God creates us in His image. And we live that for a while until the hurts come. Then we recreate, rebirth ourselves in a new image. And what Jesus is calling us to is to be born again, to rebirth again, back into the original image that we were created to be. But we don't go all the way back to the garden. We don't go all the way back to unawareness. Here's the beauty. We get to keep our awareness. We get to keep the things that we've learned. But they move back into this eight-year-old, this exuberance, this connected person, this person who understands meaning and purpose and what that's all about and what relationship is all about. And I started thinking again about the child of promise, you know, as I was talking about Brennan being my teacher and the connection between me and Abraham, however weak it may be. But Abraham has this baby at 100 years old, he and Sarai. And for all the time between the promise that Abraham got from God and the birth of Isaac, Abraham is trying to make things happen. He's trying to make that promise happen. He knows he's going to be the father of a nation. He knows he's going to be the father of many, but he hasn't got any kids. And how does this work? And so he consorts with his concubine, and Ishmael is born, and nothing but trouble ensues from all of that. He doesn't trust that the promise can happen because it was just given to him by God. He has to try to make it fit. And then the child is born, and Yitzhak in Hebrew, Isaac, means laughter. And so, you know, I've heard it say, well, that's because Sarah laughed when she heard that she was going to get pregnant because it was impossible. You know, I think it was just what Isaac brought into their lives at that age. Brennan brings so much laughter into our home. And for a 100-year-old couple to have that kind of exuberance and energy to come back in, it was the laughter that came back in. But now there was a face to the promise for Abraham. And he clung to that promise until at some point he was able to sacrifice or be willing to sacrifice that child of promise, that miracle child. The only thing that he knew that would connect him to God's promise for himself, his meaning, his purpose in life, was this child. And when he was ready to let it go, that's when he became the father of our faith. That's when he became the pillar of not just one great religion, but three in the world today. It was the willingness to let go of everything that he had been holding on to, the image that he had created in his own mind and heart about how this thing was going to play out. When he was able to let that go, then everything changed. And he moved from being in a defensive position to being in a position of pure freedom. he became a man of true faith. I was listening to the radio last week and Dennis Prager came on. I love listening to Dennis Prager. And he said that in his happiness hour, he said that unless we're willing to take emotional risks in life, we can never lead a full life. We can never actually be fully human. But it's the fear that we have. It's the hurts that we have in our memory that keep us from being able to just go for it, to just lead that full life. We keep our guard up. We stay in a defensive position. We keep our armor on. And when we do that, the people around us do it as well. It's natural. When we open up and let go, then the people around us feel free to do the same. And so it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. We keep our guard up. We hold everything in. We hang on to that self-image that we think is going to get us where we need to go. And life becomes a glass ceiling. Life becomes just reined in, limited by whatever parameters we give it. And so what we're trying to do now, and Jesus is trying to get us to do, is just to open up. He says, if you live the way I live, then this truth that you're going to find is really going to make you free. And so how do we dismantle this? How do we dismantle this image? Especially if we don't even know it's there. I mean, many of us, it's just become who we are. We don't even think about it anymore. But we know things are going wrong in our lives. We know things are difficult. We sort of know that something is wrong. You know, the pressure we feel, the anxiety, the pain, there's something wrong. But how do we even go about dismantling it? And what I really want to tell you right now is you don't do it directly. You can't do it directly. You can't hit these things that are so profound, so driven down deep into our subconscious, and just grab them by the throat and turn them into what you want them to be. It doesn't work that way. Do you know that the biggest changes in life come from the sides where you never saw them coming? The biggest changes in life happen indirectly. They're like a byproduct of the way that we live our lives. That's why Jesus says, just follow my commandments. Just do what I do. Don't even think about it. Don't worry about every incident. Just live this thing. And something's going to happen. And all of a sudden you're going to realize things have changed. You're looking at life differently. And so what does he actually tell us to do? And I know there's a lot of scriptures here on this page, and we've been already talking for a while, but don't worry, we're not going to spend a lot of time with them. But I want you to see that these milestones, these attitudes in life are important to Jesus. This is what he's trying to show us how to do. He's trying to show us how to move through life with desire, first of all. Without desire, nothing happens. If the hurts in our life don't create a desire for us to change, you know, it doesn't mean you have to hit bottom in the classic sense where everything in your life is turned to rubble and taken away. But there's got to be a desire deep in your gut that wants to move to a new place, to take you someplace. Mike and I were just talking about this earlier. The negative emotions that sometimes we say are so bad in our lives are really the motivators to create the desire for us to move forward into another place. And Jesus says in Matthew 5:4, "Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted." One of the Beatitudes at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount. But when read just this way, it doesn't mean a whole lot to us. But when you translate it back into Jesus' language, and we find out that the word mourn there, ebal, in Aramaic, means to be in turmoil or to be wandering, to be longing so deeply for something, to be longing so deeply for something to come that you're actually weak or in want from that desire. That notion of mourning in the sense of that longing, that desire, will be bayan net bayun. It means comforted. It can mean comforted, but mostly it means to be returned from the wandering. It means literally to see the face of the thing longed for to return. This is that notion of desire. Desire is an engine. Matthew 7:7, "Ask and it will be given to you, seek and you will find, knock and it will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, and he who seeks finds, and to him who knocks it will be open." But again, ask sounds so passive in our language, but selu in Aramaic is like a police interrogation. It's related to selah, which means to pray. And selah as prayer means to open a space like a hunter sets a snare for the prey and then retreats into the blind and waits expectantly for something to happen. Selah, selu. There's this sense of expectancy. There's this intensity to the asking, intensity to the desire, and an active waiting you know, in preparation for this thing to manifest. Desire being the first step on this path that takes us to being reborn. And that desire gives us a sense of our own dependence. See, the self-image that we create is the one that tries to give us an illusion of control. We've got some way that we can master our circumstances. We've got some way that we can manipulate them and make them work to our advantage. And we can get where we need to go and we can get the approval and all of those things that we crave and desire. But when it comes down to the desire taking us to another place, we realize we don't have that control no matter what we try to do. And Jesus says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And poor in spirit, again, as an English phrase, doesn't mean much to us. But meskina ruch in Aramaic is an idiom that means someone who has the attitude of poverty, even if they're rich. Someone who is not arrogant. Someone who is not domineering. Someone who is not trying to control circumstances. In other words, everything that is the exact opposite of the self-image that we have built up to try to control is what starts to fade away. We realize we haven't got any control. First step of AA is the same thing, isn't it? To just admit that we're powerless. We don't have the control that we think we can exert over the things in our lives that really count. And for theirs is the kingdom of heaven is an unfortunate translation at all. What it really is for such as these are the kingdom. These people with this attitude are what kingdom is made of. We don't own kingdom. We are kingdom in that attitude. Matthew 18, truly I say to you, unless you are converted and become like children, you will not enter the kingdom. Whoever then humbles himself as his child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And again, a childlike quality. It cracks me up when I watch Brennan, you know, still captive in our house, and yet he's exerting his own dependence. He can now go get his own iced tea, and he can put ice in it, and he brings us cookies on a plate, and he does these little things, and he's exerting more and more independence, and he's realizing these things that always came from mom and dad, he can start to do them himself, you know? And we just smile and look at each other because, okay, he's going from the kitchen to the living room. That's his independence, you know? And then there's my son Sean, the 14-year-old, who is now going and having sleepovers with his friends and doing different things, and so he's got more of a leash. And then of course our 19-year-old, who thinks she owns the world, and you know, she's got a car and she works at Wells Fargo now, and she's going to Saddleback, and so her circle is wider. And I remember at her age thinking how much independence I had. Whoa, when I got a car, that was it. You know, I could go anywhere, I could do anything, and I was on my own. You know, and here I was starting to take cross-country trips, especially between Southern California and Chicago, when I was going to school in Chicago. And you know what? How fast your independence fades when 40 miles out of Laramie, Wyoming, your car breaks down? How independent do you feel then? You know, especially back then, I didn't have AA. I didn't have a dollar to my name half the time. You know, and so this illusion of independence is so fragile. And then we look at other people, oh, they're so independent, you know, they get to travel the world, they get to do this and that. You know what? The whole world is only this big. You go from end to end, what does that mean in the face of the solar system, in the face of the universe? We're all just marking little, you know, roots on a little ball that, you know, spins in space. And we are so dependent on everything, that temperatures stay in just the right range, that everything stays exactly as it is, and everything on a razor's edge. And yet we think we have some sort of control. Jesus is pointing us toward the dependence of the child, the submission, the knowing that we are creatures. And as creatures, there is someone who provides for us. And then that leads us to this sense of allness. That when we are dependent and yet we see truth, we see something that we know is true and is pointing us toward the source of things, that we let go of everything, that we hold nothing back. Matthew 4:19, follow me and I will make you fishers of men. He's talking to Peter and Andrew, brothers who are working their nets at the Sea of Galilee. And immediately they left their nets and followed him. Immediately they just dropped it. Dropping their nets is dropping their livelihood, dropping their complete way of life and following something completely different. It's a quantum leap. You know, there's no grace period here. There's no giving notice here. They dropped their nets and they followed him. It's hard to imagine that for us. Some guy comes to your office, looks like he slept in a bush last night, and says, follow me. What do you do? You going to leave your job? You know? But this desire and this dependence prepares our heart for the apprehension of truth when it comes to us. And of course, the dropping is not a dropping of your job, but it's a knowledge that there is something that we are using to keep ourselves going that needs to be let go of. And that's a frightening thing to do. Do we have the sense of risklessness that will allow us to just let some things go? And going from there, he saw two other brothers, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, in the boat with Zebedee, their father, mending their nets. And he called to them. And immediately they left the boat and their father and followed him. Not just the boat, not just the livelihood, but now family. And family in the Hebrew context meant everything. You didn't just walk out on your father. This was the clan. This was the family business. This was survival of the family. And then to put a finer point on it, in Luke 14, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, and yes, even his own life, he can't be my disciple. We can't go where Jesus goes if we are not willing to move into this allness where we just let everything go in favor of the new thing. What we hang on to is what limits us from where Jesus is trying to take us. And in that journey following Jesus, what we are moved into is mindfulness. This place that we were talking about with Brennan, this place of being so immersed in the moment that everything is alive, everything is vibrating. And at Matthew 6:34, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will care for itself. Each day has enough troubles of its own. That's a true statement. But Jesus is trying to tell us something really profound here. Just a little bit before, he used the image of the birds of the air. Look at them, he says. They don't gather into barns, they don't sow, they don't reap, but the Father feeds them. How much more is he going to feed you? Hey, that's great. That means I don't have to work, right? I don't have to save, I don't have to plan, I don't have to do any of those things. But if you stop and you think about the actual life of a bird, they spend almost every waking moment procuring and eating food. They're constantly doing that. But they're not saving up for tomorrow. And they're not worried about yesterday and what they didn't get yesterday and what they might not get tomorrow. And they're not anxious about it. They do what they do in the moment. And Jesus is saying, that's the image here. Of course you have to work. And of course you have to plan for the future. You're not responsible if you don't do that. But if your mind is always out there in the future, regrets of the past, anxiety for the future, then you're not here and now. You're not present to each other. You're not connected to the only source you will ever have that will change anything that is obsessive and compulsive in you. You can't get there except here, now, this moment, the only moment that exists. There's no past or future. That's electrical impulses in your brain. It doesn't exist. It's what you are creating. It's part of that self-image that you have built up that he's trying to get you to dismantle. Luke 17, as he entered a village, 10 leprous men who stood at a distance met him, and they raised their voices, saying, Jesus, Master, have mercy on us. And when he saw them, he said to them, go and show yourselves to the priest. And as they were going, they were cleansed. Now one of them, when he saw that he had been healed, turned back, glorifying God with a loud voice, and fell on his face at his feet, giving thanks to him. And just for toppers, he was a Samaritan, whom the Jews hated. He's the only one who comes back. And Jesus says, where are the other nine? You know, what's wrong with them? See, this is mindfulness too, but mindfulness has gratitude. He sends the 10 off to do something. Their heads are in the future. They got to go see the priest. They got to go get announced that they are clean so they can move back into normal community life. And only one of them is present enough to see, I've been healed. I got to go back and thank the healer. I've got to go back and praise God. I've got to do a little jig on the way. He's the only one who was mindful enough to do that. And he was a Samaritan, the one who didn't follow the religious practices that they followed. Jesus is making a very, very important point here. Gratitude, the level of gratitude in our lives is a measure of our mindfulness, the measure of how, you know, just immersed in the moment that we actually are. And all of this takes us to oneness. John 14, Do you not believe that I am in the Father and the Father is in me? The words that I say to you, I do not speak on my own initiative, but the Father abiding in me does his works. This is where Jesus is leading us to. In this moment, in this mindful, grateful place, we are connected and we understand the connection, maybe for the first time. You want to know who you are? You'll never know what the question means until you can connect it to ultimate reality. Ultimate reality is what we call God. Ultimate reality is a person. Until your connection with that person is something that you've actually experienced and know something about, how can you ever say who you are? Oh, you'll rattle off a lot of the things that you do and maybe have accomplished, the relationships that you have. But that's not who you are. That's part of the image that you have created, that Jesus is trying to get us to dismantle. At John 17, the glory which you have given me, I have given to them, that they may be one just as we are one, I in them and you in me, that they may be perfected in unity, so that the world may know that you sent me and love them even as you have loved me. You know, that word glory there is kind of odd in that context, don't you think? Jesus says, the glory which you have given me, speaking to his Father in heaven, the glory you've given me, I've given to them. How does that exactly work? Because we think of glory as praise or worship, don't we? Give glory, give praise, give worship. But in the context here, the word doxa in Greek or subha in Aramaic really has a sense of approval. It has the sense of acceptance, to honor. For Jesus to sit down at table with anybody who is willing to sit down at table with him, in this sense, was to give them glory, to honor them, to approve of them, at least to the extent that they were accepted. This acceptance that the Father has for Jesus is the same acceptance that Jesus has for us. And once we are united by that, once we can sit down at table together, then everything else becomes possible. And we start to realize that we're seeing life in a new way, through the Father's eyes. And the big changes that have been occurring all along that came from the sides where we didn't realize it start to become real. And we see ourselves handling situations differently. We see ourselves reacting to situations differently. And we realize that something fundamentally is changing in our lives. And so this self-image that we have carried around for decades is like a child that we have raised, you know. It's our child. It's who we see ourselves to be. And we've nurtured it, and we've cared for it, and we brought it along, and it's tearing us down, and we don't even realize it. In closing, I wanted to just read you this little piece that, if you haven't heard before, it's one of the most beautiful pieces. It's from Khalil Gibran's book, The Prophet, and it's on children. And as you're hearing what he says about children, double think this with me. And think about the child that you have created, the self-image that you have been holding on to all your life since you were hurt as a child. And he writes, your children are not your children. They are the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself. They come through you, but not from you. And though they are with you, yet they belong not to you. You may give them your love, but not your thoughts. For they have their own thoughts. You may house their bodies, but not their souls, for their souls dwell in the house of tomorrow, which you cannot visit, not even in your dreams. You may strive to be like them, but seek not to make them like you. For life goes not backward, nor tarries with yesterday. You are the bows from which your children, as living arrows, are sent forth. The archer sees the mark upon the path of the infinite, and he bends you with his might, that his arrows may go swift and far. Let your bending in the archer's hand be for gladness, for even as he loves the arrow that flies, so he loves also the bow that is stable. Our self-image is this child that we have created. It's not ours. It's not us. We can let it go. Holding on to our children too tightly stunts them and stifles them and keeps them from being able to grow and go where they need to go. simultaneously it stunts and stifles ourselves because we are trying to live vicariously through them, like a stage mother, you know, who is taking her child everywhere because she missed out on something in life and is trying to recreate it through this child. And that's exactly what we do with this self-image. We're trying to live vicariously through it when there is another life that is so open and so amazing that we can't even imagine. Can you remember who you were when you were 7 or 8? Can you even go back that far? Can you remember who you were before you got hurt the first time? Were you the kind of kid that was exuberant and running around? Were you the kind of kid that loved to read and play in your room alone? Or were you the kind of kid that wanted to be out with the kids on the street? That is you. That's the pure manifestation of your personality. Jesus is trying to get us to go back to the garden, bringing with us everything that we have learned as adults so that we can be the full expression of our life in kingdom, our full expression in our oneness and connection with the Father. It's a beautiful thing. We just have to be willing to let go of everything we think is what keeps us going. Let's pray. Oh, Father, unfortunately, life is a scary thing. It's scary and it's unknown, and all of that stuff keeps us afraid and keeps us in a defensive position. And the only thing that runs counter to it, we know, is you, Lord, but it's hard to go there sometimes. So, Father, just keep working on us. Help us to keep showing up and just staying on the path and learning little by little that no matter what things look like, it's going to be okay in the end because you are there waiting for us and you are there here for us. You've always been here for us. So thank you, Father, once again for loving us the way that you do. Help us to continue to fall deeper and deeper into your center and become the people you created us to be. Help us to become born again as these living arrows to move forth and to just realize the happiness that we can have in kingdom here now, in your name, in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen.